heart, not about her biography, but about the power and meaning of what she brings to the Aspen Institute. She has encouraged us to be not only a think tank, but an action tank. She has helped, she's been the co-chair of our Middle East Strategy Group, helped develop some plans for us to invest in the Middle East, bring small entrepreneurs to the Middle East, and even as things go up and down in the Middle East, we're going to persevere on that road. She has been a senator who has been on every single issue, from foreign policy to domestic policy to intelligence, a real touchstone of common sense. We're lucky to have her because she's the type of person who could be up for re-election and you wouldn't even know it because nobody would dare oppose her in California. So, yeah, I know you're opposed, but you just don't look worried to me, Senator. But of the many, many issues in which she's a touchstone of common sense, one of them is global warming, probably the most important issue facing the next generation, our kids' generation. But now, as we've seen so recently, with so much happening, it's facing our generation as well. So it's my deep pleasure to introduce somebody who's always been a close friend of ours, Senator Feinstein.
Thank you, Walter. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you very much, Walter. And I guess one of the best things that my husband and I do is our participation in the Aspen Institute. And I'm so pleased that you're here as well. I'm delighted because a couple of members of my family are here, my husband, my stepdaughter, my granddaughter. And so it's a real treat for me to be able to spend this hour with you. Monday evening, some of us viewed Al Gore's An Inconvenient Truth. The point of that film is really very clear. The planet Earth, our planet, will change drastically unless we take strong action right now. So today, I want to speak with you about this greatest environmental challenge, global warming. Some of what I say, if you saw the film, it would be repetitious, but it's important, and I think it bears repetition. Let me begin with a few examples. The danger signals are all around us, from the melting snows of Kilimanjaro to the projected increase in the ferocity of hurricanes, like in the Gulf. Global warming is causing major changes around the world. Coral reefs are dying, glaciers are melting, species are disappearing. Eskimo villages have been already lost to rising waters, and traditional life in the Andes is being dramatically altered because of changes in farming patterns. Winters in the Arctic are 4 to 5 degrees warmer than they were 30 years ago. And this has caused longer seasons without sea ice. And so polar bears have been unable to find their favorite sources of food, ringed seals. And as a result, the bears near the Beaufort Sea have turned to cannibalism to survive. Now, if nothing changes, these majestic creatures will be extinct by the end of this century. And these are not isolated incidents. The simple, inescapable truth is that global warming cannot be stopped. The world's temperature is going to rise. And here's why. Carbon dioxide doesn't dissipate. It stays in the atmosphere for 5 decades or more. So the carbon dioxide produced in the 50s, the 60s, the 70s, the 80s, and 90s are still in the atmosphere today. And the carbon dioxide produced today will still be in the atmosphere in 2050 and beyond. Global warming is happening, and it's impossible to stop it. But the question is this: can we limit this Earth's warming to 1 to 2 degrees, or will it climb by 4 or 5 degrees or more by the end of the century? Now, the difference is enormous. So we're at a tipping point right now. Refuse to act or act too slowly, and humans will have caused the most sudden temperature shift in the history of the planet. If we act soon and decisively, global warming can be controlled. If warming is limited to 1 to 2 degrees Fahrenheit by the end of the century, the most devastating effects can be averted. This, I contend, should be our goal. But if nothing is done, if the Earth warms 4 degrees or more in the next 50 years, the face of our planet will be changed forever. 3 out of 5 species will become extinct. Oceans will rise. Flooding will occur. Hurricanes will be more powerful. Malaria will spread. Tim Flannery, an Australian scientist and the author of a book called The Weathermakers, and that book is one of the most interesting and readable books on global warming. He says that we need to make wholesale changes to avoid the disaster. Incidentally, the book is in the bookstore, and that's just directly to the left as you leave the auditorium. So if you want to pick up a copy and take a look at it, it is well worth your read. Tim Flannery estimates that a 70% reduction in carbon dioxide emissions below 1990 levels by the middle of the century, it's by 2050, is required to stabilize the Earth's climate by the year 2100. This, I believe, should be our goal. But the truth is, there's no easy way to achieve this, and there is no single way to achieve it. So what we need is a commitment across the board, from individuals, from businesses, and from state and federal and local governments to address the challenge. And that should be our task. Let me just quickly describe why we need to act now. The Earth's history is in many ways the story of changing climate. The pattern over the past million years has been clear. Vacillation between colder ice ages and warmer interglacial periods, each lasting many thousands of years. For most of this history, humans lived a largely nomadic existence, hunting and gathering in an ongoing search for food. This continued until about 8,000 years ago, when a stable, warm period began. Humans took advantage of this stability. We grew crops. We domesticated animals. We established towns and villages. And it was a huge step forward. And it led to the rise of civilization and, of course, the beginning of recorded history. But it should also have consequences that were not going to be felt for thousands of years. Then there was a second turning point, which came a little bit more than 200 years ago when the Industrial Revolution began. The great machines that powered this revolution all required fossil fuel to run, oil, coal, natural gas. And since then, concentrations of carbon dioxide have increased to the highest levels in the past 10 million years. And as carbon dioxide levels rise, so do global temperatures. If you saw Al Gore's chart, they went right up the line together. The hottest year on record is 2005. The 1990s were the hottest decade on record, and it appears that the current decade is going to be even hotter. And if we don't act soon, the level of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere will more than double and lead to unimaginable consequences. And we, the United States, bear substantial responsibility for this problem. We are responsible for 25% of the world's greenhouse gas emissions, though we have only 4% of the world's population. This makes our country the largest emitter of greenhouse gases in the world. And today, the United States is faced with a stark choice. Do we continue our reckless use of energy, or do we choose a meaningful way to be more energy efficient? This is the choice between a Hummer and a Prius, between coal and renewables, between business as usual and the adoption of major change. I think the choice is clear. Global warming is not some far-off nightmare. It's happening today. The earth is warm that 1 degree in the last century. And just with 1 degree of warming, let me show you what's happened. Antarctica, 36 million miles, cubic miles, 36 cubic miles of ice is melting into the sea each year. The northern tips are turning green. Greenland's glaciers are melting. Since 79, 16% of Greenland sheet ice has melted. In the last 5 years, the melting has doubled. If these glaciers were to melt completely, it would raise sea levels globally 21 feet just from Greenland. Glacier National Park. The glaciers in the park in Montana are shrinking. Today, the park's largest glaciers are only about a third of what they were in 1850, and many small mountain glaciers have disappeared completely during the past 150 years. Scientists predict that all of these glaciers will be gone by 2030. Alaska, the Portage Glacier, is retreating at a rate of 50 meters a year and is no longer visible in its visitor center. Between 79 and 2005, Arctic sea ice deteriorated by 20% or more. Animals, the golden toad, the harlequin frog on the hillsides of Costa Rica. The golden toad is now extinct, and there were once hundreds of thousands of them. And the harlequin frog has all but disappeared. And this is because warmer temperature causes the clouds to rise above the forests where these frogs and many other creatures live. As the clouds have risen, the life-sustaining mist has disappeared, and this has exposed frogs, as well as other animals, to killer fungal disease. The mountain pine beetle, this tiny insect which inhabits the Pacific coast and Canada, is a voracious predator of pine trees. Global warming, this 1 degree change, has allowed the population of the pine beetle to explode. So what's the result? In 2003, the pine beetle killed 60% of the ponderosa pine trees across the San Bernardino and San Jacinto Mountains. This was the biggest forest die-off in the United States in 6,000 years. Globally, the sea level has risen 4 to 10 inches during the past century, and it's estimated that a 1 foot sea level rise is likely to occur along the Gulf and Atlantic coast by the middle of this century. In California, my state, our water supply, since 1990, global warming has caused a decrease in annual precipitation over much of my state from 10% to as much as 25%. The lack of rainfall will be catastrophic for us. In addition, the Sierra Nevada snowpack, the source of much of California's drinking water, could shrink by an amount greater than the annual water consumption of Southern California's 16 million people by the end of the century. So if this is what happens with 1 degree of warming, think of what it'll mean if there's another 4 to 5 degrees or more of warming this century. So what do we do? The key is a society-wide commitment from business and from individuals and from the federal government. So today I want to talk about 5 of the most doable steps and programs that we should take. All they require is the public's will to change and the political will to change. The first is fuel economy. We've got to substantially increase the fuel economy of automobiles, trucks, SUVs. United States cars and pickup trucks are responsible for nearly half of the greenhouse gases emitted by automobiles globally. So our automobiles emit half of what automobiles emit all around the planet. Why? This is because our cars are driven further, have lower fuel economy, and use fuels that produce more carbon dioxide. So in total, vehicles in the United States produce nearly 1.5 billion tons of CO2 a year. Automobiles contribute 4 billion tons of CO2 a year worldwide. So we need to take strong steps toward reducing the amount of emissions in these vehicles. And that's why I've introduced, along with Senator Olympia Snowe of Maine, about a month ago, bipartisan legislation with 11 co-sponsors that would increase fuel economy standards for all cars and SUVs from 25 to 35 miles per gallon over the next 10 years. And the reason we chose this was to make the first breakthrough, because all the technology to do this is there, and the thing that stops it is the recalcitrance of Detroit. We would avoid 420 million tons of carbon dioxide from being released into the atmosphere each year just with this measure. This is the equivalent of taking 90 million cars off the road. By 2025, this one measure could save 2.5 million barrels of oil a day. Now, that equals the daily importation of oil into this country today. We import daily 2.5 billion barrels of oil. So we could do that just by increasing fuel efficiency. We cut back on our need of oil. Secondly, we need to replace the traditional gasoline-powered internal combustion engine with engines and fuels that produce much less carbon dioxide. These include the electric plug-in hybrid, biodiesel, hydrogen, and ethanol 85 made from cellulosic ethanol. It's very clear to me that what our government should do is create a market for alternative fuels and for flex fuel vehicles. Incentives should be devised so that a high percentage of new vehicles are flex fuel. These vehicles should have a yellow gasoline cap so that consumers can easily identify them. And additionally, a proportion of gas stations should be required to have E85 and biodiesel pumps. Currently, there are 5 million flex fuel vehicles on the road in the United States. Many people don't know they have them. And there are only 600 pumping stations for E85 and biodiesel around the country. This, I think, was taken from one. There's one service station that has these pumps in Washington, only one. It happens to be near the Pentagon, and my staff took that picture of it just yesterday. Traditional cars can be converted to run on E85 with a simple adjustment of the computer controls of the automobile and fuel tank. And this would create an 80% improvement in carbon dioxide emissions from vehicles. Biodiesel made from soybeans or vegetable oil can reduce emissions by 78% when compared with regular diesel. 37 million gallons of biodiesel were produced in 2004 in our country, and that number has jumped to 75 million in 2005. So it's beginning to happen, although it's slow, and consumers need to demand that the private marketplace as well as government move in this direction. Third, we've got to create a national framework for business to reduce greenhouse gases. I and my staff are working on a mandatory cap and trade system, which would involve agriculture and reward farmers with credits for the sequestration of carbon. What we did was we took the McCain-Lieberman bill, which failed in the Senate last year, tried to figure out why it failed, and work from there to strengthen it and tweak it in a number of ways by adding agriculture as one of them. This would help move our society away from our dependence on coal and toward cleaner and more efficient technologies. And what's difficult is the main fuel in 38 out of the 50 states is coal. So if coal won't respond, you can't get the votes to pass anything in the United States Senate. In the United States, coal-fired power plants are the largest United States source of carbon dioxide. They produce 2.5 billion tons every year. That's approximately 35% of our emissions. If you combine the transportation sector, airplanes, cars, trucks, SUVs, and coal, they equal together 65% of the CO2 production in America. So this tells you where you have to go. And globally, coal produces 9.3 billion tons of carbon dioxide every year, or 33% of global greenhouse gas emissions. Coal is the major culprit in global warming. And that's why it's so important that we find ways either to clean up coal or find alternative sources of fuel. Let me tell you a little bit about the proposal. Cap and trade is not a new solution. It has a good track record. Major reductions, for instances, were made in the emissions that cause acid rain, and those chemicals are sulfur dioxide and nitrous oxide. And by 2004, the acid rain cap and trade program had reduced sulfur dioxide emissions by over 5 million tons. That's about 34% from 1990 levels, and had cut nitrous oxide emissions by about 3 million tons from 1990 levels. That's a 43% reduction. What's my point? My point is a simple one. Cap and trade, if mandatory, can work. One of the key elements of this program that we're drafting is that farmers and foresters would be able to earn credits for reductions through green practice, including conservation tillage or storing additional carbon in the soil by tilling the soil less while farming. There you have an example. Planting trees on unused land, converting crops into biofuels, producing electricity from biomass without using fossil fuels. So let me give you an example of how it would work. Let's say a farmer decides not to till his soil. This would prevent carbon dioxide from entering the atmosphere in two areas, from not disturbing the soil and from not running his diesel-fueled tractor as much. He could earn $5 to $20 an acre by doing that. That's a conservative estimate based on European market prices. If the farmer implemented this practice on 500 acres, he would earn $2,500 to $10,000 a year. This would save 250 to 500 tons of carbon dioxide each year, and it would incentivize farmers to participate and do their part. Now, at the same time, I recognize that what happens with these bills is you have the opposition of coal and you have the opposition of the utilities. So it's been important for me to find a business entity with which to work, and I think we've found it. The CEO of my local utility, Pacific Gas and Electric, his name is Peter Darby, is very global warming conscious, and he wants to help. So we are doing some of our modeling with their cooperation. Now, pulverized coal power plants are the largest source of electricity in our country, as I mentioned, and they produce the most carbon dioxide. And this is a huge problem, but it's got to be faced. And that's why it's so important that research into new technologies be expedited. Every day that a pulverized coal plant is built, either in the United States or China or elsewhere, that plant will pollute the atmosphere for 50 years. And this is clearly the wrong direction. So we've got to find new carbon-free and low-carbon power-generating technologies to replace the coal, pulverized coal power plant. Fourth, we've really got to promote energy efficiency. And the surprise here, I think, is how much bang for the buck there is. Let me give you three small examples. An energy-efficient light bulb. This is a 30-watt compact fluorescent bulb. It's equivalent to a 100-watt light bulb. It can just fit in your socket, and it'll reduce, over the life of the bulb, 1,300 pounds of carbon dioxide from going into the air. And all it takes is for you to buy them and screw them in. 30 watts equals 100 watts. Energy Star air conditioners, furnaces, boilers, windows. In 2005, Americans using Energy Star products reduced greenhouse gas emissions equal to that of 23 million cars and saved $12 billion on their utility bills. Easy to do, and it works. Updated building codes. Residential and commercial buildings account for one-third of United States energy use and carbon emissions. Green construction exists today. It's cost-effective. And that's why I'm working with Senator Jeffords of Vermont on a bill to promote green building in the federal government. The bill would also provide grants to school districts to build green school buildings. It's just a start. State and local building codes need to change, and they need to adopt green codes. And you've got to help me. You've got to demand that governments do so. One of the things that bothered me most when I was mayor of San Francisco was that all new office buildings were being built in this naturally air-conditioned city with fixed windows. And so today their air conditioning runs virtually 24/7. If individuals would do some small things, they could make such a big difference. Cool your water heater down by 10 degrees, your hot water heater down by 10 degrees. That saves 660 pounds of CO2 per household from being emitted. If every household were to do it, California alone would avoid emitting 3.8 million metric tons of carbon dioxide. It adds up. Wash 4 out of 5 loads of laundry in cold water. That avoids 460 pounds of CO2 from being emitted, or 2.7 million metric tons for all of my state, the largest in the union. Run your dishwasher only with a full load. That avoids 200 pounds of carbon dioxide from being emitted. Turn the air conditioner thermostat up a single degree. That avoids 220 pounds of CO2 from being emitted per household per year. And that's 1.3 metric tons for all of my state. Carpool, 2 days a week. That avoids 1,590 pounds of CO2 from being emitted. Keep car tires properly inflated. That avoids 250 pounds of CO2. It all works. And what I'm most proud to say is that my home state, California, is leading the way in energy efficiency. California has implemented aggressive energy efficiency standards and increasingly green building codes. The per capita use of energy in California has remained constant over the past 20 years, while national per capita energy consumption has increased by 50%. Think about it. California is a diverse state. It's an economic, it's fifth largest economic powerhouse on earth. If we can do it and contain it, the rest of America can do it. Just last week, a California Senate committee passed out a bill to mandate a cap of greenhouse gases it would be a 25% reduction by 2020. And last September, the state announced a $2 billion energy efficiency and conservation program. So it's estimated that this program will reduce energy costs for homes and businesses by more than $5 billion. Now, from a climate change perspective, California's program is expected to decrease the state's carbon dioxide emissions by approximately 3.4 million tons by 2008. Now, that's the equivalent of taking 650,000 automobiles off the road. So California's actions need to be replicated. They're not complicated. They're not difficult. They can be done. The question is, we need a national mandate to do this. And hopefully, if America does it, other countries will do it in similar fashion. Because of the savings, this is about one quarter of what it would take to get to that 70% of 1990 carbon dioxide emissions. And they're all things that every one of us in this room can do. Finally, and my final point, the United States has to show leadership internationally. And I can't tell you how disappointed I am at our lack of leadership. Kyoto is certainly not perfect, and it will expire in 2012. But the United States needs to be an active participant on the global level to ensure that there is a framework in place for significant reductions after 2012. And that's the only way we're going to prevent catastrophic climate change. Some doubt whether global warming can be controlled. I say it can. I read an op-ed piece this morning in the Washington Post by Mr. Samuelson that said it can't be controlled, you know, give up. That's nonsense. And there is nothing, you know, I'm sitting here with a 13-year-old grandchild. I cannot end my life leaving her an earth that becomes doomed. I just can't do it, nor can anyone in this room. And that means we have to step up to the plate and we have to change. And it can be done. Great Britain has already brought their emissions to 14% below 1990 levels. So steps toward this goal can be achieved. Great Britain has a comprehensive program, requires commercial electricity suppliers to generate 10% of their renewable resources by 2010. They make grants available for the installation of these sources. They provide incentives for the use of more fuel-efficient vehicles and alternative fuels. Now, this is how bad it is. Last year in the Senate, we passed a similar bill, but it was dropped in conference by the Republican majority. And you might say, well, I'm being partisan. But we have to face up to this. If, as all scientists are coming together to believe, global warming is real, and if we cannot stop it, but we can control it, we have to do it. And so we have to begin to pass some of these measures. We have to walk before we run, but we've got to break this gridlock in the Congress. The bottom line is there is no one silver bullet, but there are a whole series of things that we can do to achieve that 70% of CO2 emissions by 1990. And our stewardship does make a difference. It does matter. We can't leave this planet hotter. So the private sector also has a role to play. And we need to harness American ingenuity. We've got people here who are masters at what they do. And they have to come to realize, CEOs have to come to realize that this is important. And how can they change their company's actions and performance? How can they develop a corporate ethic? I hope PG&E will lead the way in the utility business. We'll see. So there are many things that can be done to solve this problem. And I just beg you, don't shift the burden to the next generation. We created this crisis, and it's up to us to find the solution. And so I believe the time has come to stop talking and take action. I've tried to outline today 5 courses of practical, doable actions, which if we were able to put in place adequately, I believe we could reach that goal of reducing CO2 from 1990 levels by 70% by the year 2050. And if we were to achieve that, there is a good likelihood that we could control warming to 1 to 2 degrees by the end of the century. Don't you think it's worth a try? I do. Thank you very much. Sure.
She will, of course, take some questions, and there's the microphones. But I'm going to use the moderator's prerogative real quick to say, I was at a dinner at the Resnicks, and every environmentalist there said they'd changed their mind. They were deeply in favor of nuclear energy as a way to deal with global warming. I was rather surprised. What on the list?
You want me to say something about that? That's the logical thinking right now. The problem is it takes so long to get a nuclear plant through. And most of the utilities in California, we have 10, 15 years to do it. We really can't wait when some of these other things we can move forward with. All it takes is the political will to do it.
Would you change the regulations so that we could move forward faster?
Well, the mandatory cap and trade system is geared to force companies to move in different directions because it's costly to them not to, and they're rewarded if they do. That's what mandatory cap and trade is. Now, there are technical questions about auctions and offsets, and if anyone would like to see our draft bill, please let me know because we're circulating it. We have not introduced it yet. Once you introduce it, you're kind of stuck with it, but we haven't introduced it yet. And so we're trying to get as much input as we can prior to that time.
Senator Feinstein.
Yes, sir.
Thank you for your support on this effort. I'm an investment banker, and I work with the President's Council of Environmental Defense.
I can't see you. Can you wave?
I'm hiding over in the corner here.
Thank you. Okay.
I have 2 comments that I'd like to get your reaction to. The first one is, and I hate to talk about economics with Alan Greenspan in the room, very dangerous, but we obviously have a free good here in our air that on a probability-weighted basis all the data would show, even if we can't prove it, that we have a problem. I think there's 2 ways to protect that free good. One is to set up a structure where the market figures out the best solutions. The second is for the government to back products. And I really liked your commentary. Obviously, environmental defense, we like cap and trade. But I think that the mother of all product support would be E85, which is not very efficient to turn corn into a fuel. If we were in Brazil and we had sugar, that'd be great. But we take a subsidized product, we subsidize it some more, and then now maybe we subsidize it further. So I'd ask you for your comment on market solutions and innovation versus government supporting products. The second thing I'd like your comment on is you mentioned Kyoto, and there have been many regional initiatives on cap and trade, but many of you saw when we think about the private sector here, if you follow this, carbon credits fell from $1,600 a ton to $800 a ton in the last 2 months, in a matter of a couple days. One of the things to think about is whatever you in Congress do, without global fungibility, without a global market for carbon, that'll be an inefficient market. Businesses won't be able to rely on it, and we'll have a very difficult time reducing emissions. So the comment would be on market forces versus backing products and on fungibility.
Right. What is your name?
Alan Greenspan.
John Anda. I don't think so.
John Anda.
Well, John.
So environmental defense.
Yes, Fred. I work with Fred Krupp.
Okay. Would you be willing to work with us and take a look at what my staff is drafting on the mandatory cap and trade bill? I think that's the first thing.
Yes, absolutely. And I would speak for Fred Krupp and say that Fred and the people, I'm on his president's council, but we would be happy to work. We worked extensively on McCain-Lieberman, still support some version of that bill going forward, again, with an emphasis on market solutions, not backing products.
Yeah.
I'm old enough to have been involved in SynFuels in project finance back the last time we had these issues, and it was quite a disaster.
Yeah, let me share with you one of, from a position of an elected office holder. One of my greatest issues with the environmental community is that in most things that I've done, I've asked them for help up front. Will you look at this? When we did the Headwaters Forest up in Northern California, when we did the salt flats, Cargill salt ponds in San Francisco Bay, and they reserve judgment. And then when you do something, they criticize it. And my view is if the environmental community is really going to have an impact, we've got to walk before we run, and therefore taking steps, albeit not total, if they get the votes and get passed, if they get the signature of a president, is a major step in the right direction. And I've sent the cap and trade out to all the environmental organizations. We don't get any comments back.
You will get a comment
to leave
from
you
myself
with that.
And environmental defense.
And then I know when I introduce it, it'll be, well, it's not enough. But in any event, I leave that. E85, I think you're right. I think the first thing we have to do is remove the tariff of 54 cents. Ethanol coming into our country has both a tariff of 54 cents, it's got a subsidy, and it's got a mandate. So there are three very powerful things going for it. But cellulosic, E85, we've got to create the incentives to build the plants to do this in this country. And I think I've just read a paper by Vinod Khosla and hope to talk with him. He's here this week about it. You're here. It was a very good paper. I got a great deal from it, so thank you very much. How we can create those incentives to really grow an E85 capacity in this country. Your final one I forgot. Does that cover it? Feasibility?
Fungibility
of what?
In other words, businesses won't invest in clean technologies. The basis for that investment is that they have a sense of what those credits will be worth when they go to sell them in the market. So a market that trades like aluminum trades globally is a very predictable commodity. It will have futures and derivatives and a spot market. That kind of an efficient spot market with a tight bid-ask spread, those things are very boring to most of the people in the group. But to business executives like all these companies up here, that's the basis on which they will make green investments. So it's very important that what you do in Congress creates, ideally, global fungibility.
Well, that, of course, is right. And the devil's in the details of how you do it. And this is why I welcome all comers to be of help in the drafting of this. It just so happens that my staff is very good. He's from the Energy Committee of the Senate. I'm very lucky to have him. And we've been trying to reach out, and he's been trying to reach out. It's very difficult to get people to participate. So we'd welcome your thoughts. Anybody else?
Yep.
Yes, sir.
Okay, thank you. I'm Atta Mutambara from Zimbabwe.
How do you do?
Doing well. I start by saluting your good work that you're doing on the environment and the global warming issue. But I want to say a few comments that will make your job easier. Senator, you need more than a national mandate. Yes, you need a national mandate, but what you've described is a global problem, not an American problem, but a global problem. So you need to move from a state mandate to a national mandate. And beyond that, you need a global mandate. Now, how do you get a global mandate to address the issues of global warming? Number one, I accept that global warming is one global challenge. There's extreme poverty as a global challenge. There's the issue of human rights as a global challenge. Just to dramatize so you can understand what I'm talking about. I'm from Zimbabwe. I cannot organize a meeting. I'm an opposition leader in Zimbabwe. I can't organize a meeting to discuss the environment without getting arrested. So human rights as a global challenge is also an issue that has to be considered. So what I'm saying to you is, accept that there's global warming as a global challenge, there's extreme poverty as a global challenge, there's issue of human rights as a global challenge, there's global terrorism as a challenge. Now, what you need to do is to understand the interconnectedness of these challenges so that you don't just address one issue, but understand how they are related and then understand how you do your prioritization depending on how they're interconnected so that the global warming agenda makes sense to a starving peasant in Zimbabwe. So that the starving peasant in Zimbabwe realizes that if they do not resolve the issue of global warming, there'll be no Zimbabwe in 20 years' time. So we need to address the issue of extreme poverty in America, in the ghettos of America. There are starving people, there's poverty in America. So what I'm saying is, to make your job easier, let's accept there are so many challenges and they're interconnected, and then by understanding the interconnectedness, we can derive the prioritization of our agenda. But however, I salute your work. We need to get a global mandate.
Well, thank you very much. And of course, you raise very good points. Zimbabwe's contribution to the production of CO2 is very, very small, as is most of Africa, as is many parts of India and many other places. It's really the big industrial powers that I think have the burden in this problem, because we are the culprits. And we are the ones that are producing the CO2. And, you know, just a simple thing like CAFE standards, which is fuel efficiency standards of American automobiles, has been so difficult. Senator Snow and I tried with just SUVs, just to produce a loophole. A sedan has 27.5 miles. An SUV has 20 miles requirement to the gallon. We wanted to bring just SUVs up to that of a sedan, and we couldn't do it because the opposition from the automotive industry in this country. And that's one of the reasons why Toyota is eating their lunch. And it's got to be understood. So the fight that we have just to get something passed that starts us. The only thing that was passed was a sense of the Senate, which means nothing. Nothing happens except to say, this is what we think. That makes no sense when this is happening worldwide. Get Tim Flannery's book and read it, and you see the impact. Now, what's happening where a lot of sub-Saharan Africa is being affected because farming patterns and drought is now much more pronounced. And Flannery points out this is a direct product of global warming. So this is how your country might well be affected by it. No other questions? If not, then thank you very much. Enjoyed spending the hour with Help Me. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you very much.
You're better than ever.
Oh, well, I tried. This is what we can do. See, with help, I could get all this stuff through.